This is an ABC Radio National podcast, and we have many more to choose from, which you can hear details about after this program. But right now, we hope you enjoy this podcast.
On ABC Radio National, hello there. Geraldine Doogue with you, and great to have you with us for the final Boyer Lecture for 2008. These are always historic occasions. Australians of note put on the record their ideas and concerns. And for the record, our 49th lecturer, Rupert Murdoch, wants to be remembered as ever hopeful, an enthusiast for Australia's part in the new world. But there is something more, for this is not the bloodless speech of a corporate chief positioning his company for change. After all, he has ample opportunity for that in other arenas, and we hear him doing that. Yes, you could say that what he has put forward over the past 5 weeks is no surprise. Support for free trade, the virtues of the market economy, and the advantages of adopting new technology. But there's been another theme, I'd suggest to you, playing in the background, and it would be a deaf ear indeed that fails to hear it. A mellow tone of affection, deep affection, for the place of his birth, that willful, lavish land of Dorothea McKellar, as he quoted with much emotion in his opening lecture. Well, it'll ring clearly today in his final address. It's been an absorbing journey, and now it comes to an end with the sixth lecture. So here is Rupert Murdoch on the 21st century, comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable.
For the last few weeks, I've shared with you my thoughts about some of the important trends and currents crashing up against our world. I've spoken of the challenging but ultimately liberating impact of technology. I've spoken about my own industry's need to adapt to an internet age by turning newspapers into news brands that have what all great papers have, the trust and confidence of their readers. I've spoken about the urgent imperative for education reform, so that those without riches or connections can rise in society and build a better life for themselves and their families. And I've spoken about the tremendous competition generated by the entry into the global marketplace of billions of workers who have previously been isolated or cut off. But these lectures are not about technology or newspapers or education or globalization. These lectures are about people and what happens when human talent, ingenuity, and ambition is given free rein. Over the past six decades, the unleashing of these creative energies has raised the standard of living for hundreds of millions of people. And I believe that the opportunities before us today are even greater, and bringing us to a new golden age for humankind. Across the world, poor societies are becoming rich, and rich societies are slipping. Nations from Russia and China to Venezuela and Iran are showing the world that they resent the global status quo. And as we are seeing, they are challenging that status quo. Sometimes the choices these countries make leave the world more prosperous and stable, as in China's decision to join the international marketplace. Sometimes the choices these countries make leave the world a little more dangerous, as in Russia's invasion of Georgia. In all these cases, we are talking about big changes. And the cold truth is this: Australia is not preparing itself adequately for the challenges ahead. The reason for this is also clear. We are too comfortable, and when we are comfortable, we are often willing to settle for less so long as we don't have to change how we do things. Some people who look at the changes going on elsewhere in the world will tell you that if Australia doesn't do this or doesn't do that, the consequences will be dire. I have a different message. In fact, I'm reasonably sure that the consequences will probably not be dire. In my mind, that's the problem. Today, instant flows of information, the advance of trade and the rise of economies that reward risk and enterprise are all combining to create a world where the opportunities ahead will be greater than anything we've seen in human history. Will Australia take its place in this golden age? Or will we settle for the bronze, just getting by? At this time in our history, the gravest threat to Australia's freedom and prosperity does not come from war or terrorism. It comes from the comfort that can make us content. Here is how I see it. In the 21st century, Australia's open economy, free society, and strategic location give us many advantages. They also give us a clear choice. Australia can be a model for the world, or we can be a land of squandered opportunity. That is the challenge we face. It is especially true for younger Australians. As the chief executive of a media company that is engaged all over this world, I have some definite opinions about where the world is heading. My view of the world owes something to my upbringing in Melbourne. I was raised in a newspaper family by a father who believed that the newspaper was among the most important instruments of human freedom. In 1947, my father said that the press must be more than merely free. It must be fact-finding and truth-seeking to the limit of human capacity and enterprise. My father also instilled in me some guiding principles that remain with me today. These principles and the experiences I have lived through continue to shape the way I look at the world. I was born into an Australia that was a firm part of a British Empire on which the sun had not yet set. I lived in a Pacific where hundreds of millions suffered from terrible poverty and cruel dictators. And European colonialism from Fiji to Malaya was taken for granted. And I'm old enough to remember when sophisticated society held that these people were not fit for the democratic freedoms that we in Australia enjoyed. Incidentally, a patronizing idea not altogether dead yet in certain Western elites. That old world may seem very far from the one you and I know today. But the truth is, the majority of the most profound changes that have taken place are relatively recent, and Australia's own history attests to the dramatic change we are seeing. As borders diminish, as people claim their freedom, and as technology allows people to communicate more cheaply and efficiently than ever before. For younger listeners, it must be hard to imagine what life was like just a few short decades back. You've grown up in a world where you can sit on a beach and ring a friend in Pakistan. With the click of a mouse, you can send information to a mate on the other side of the world. And so long as you have access to the internet, you can read about last night's footy match before you go to bed in Los Angeles. My experience had been very different. I grew up in an Australia that did not have a national newspaper until my company, with meager resources, started one. Remember, this was not the Dark Ages. This was 1964. Yet even allowing for these problems, Australia was coming into her own. The turning point probably started with World War II. Those of you who lived through those days know what I'm talking about. When Singapore fell, I was 10 years old. I remember how worried we all were for the Australians who were taken prisoner. I also remember when General MacArthur arrived in Australia and made his famous vow to return to the Philippines. Partly I remember it because we moved out of our home in Melbourne so MacArthur's staff could use it. As a child, I saw the fear Australians experienced when the Japanese struck Darwin. More bombs were dropped there than at Pearl Harbor. At school, we read about the exploits of the Fuzzy Wuzzy Angels, the ordinary people of New Guinea who risked their lives to help injured Australian troops down the Kokoda Trail. I also remember some of the more politically incorrect moments. For example, in June 1942, the Japanese sent their midget submarines to attack Sydney. They did not accomplish much, sinking one unarmed ship. And I recall some people in Melbourne seemed amused by the thought of all those wealthy Sydneysiders seeing the value of their beachfront property plummet. Our inter-city rivalry was even stronger in those days. The war dragged on until the atomic bomb was dropped on Japan. But the relief would be short-lived. In the 1950s, we had the war in Korea. In the 1960s and 70s, it was in Vietnam. In the 1980s, the Cold War still seemed to be going strong until President Reagan faced the Russians down. Now we have a war against radical Islamic terrorists that has been going on for years. Whatever the merits of these conflicts, Australians have been involved in all of them, and it still troubles me that our citizens do not seem to appreciate the sacrifices of those who serve in our armed forces, at least not the way they do in America. That, too, is another legacy we would do well to change. But my larger point is that war is not unique to our time. What is unique is the expansion of freedom. In no other age has freedom advanced as far, or as fast, or in such unexpected places. Nowhere has freedom changed a neighbourhood as dramatically as it has ours. Before World War II, the only other real democracy in our region was New Zealand, and many people thought that's how it would always be. Even though Australia was geographically situated in the Pacific, back then we were never really part of the region. Instead, we were linked to Britain, politically, economically, and culturally. Today, all this has changed for the better. Japan went from the militaristic empire that threatened to invade us to a successful democracy that is a partner for peace. Up and down the Pacific, mothers and fathers who once knew only dictatorship and misery now have children who are growing up in freedom and prosperity. Businessmen who started out with small companies have made their brands globally known for quality and value. It's easy to take these developments for granted. But back in the 1940s, anyone who dared predict this kind of future for the Asia-Pacific region would have been dismissed as barking mad. The Second World War was in many ways the transition point. Before that war, the Imperial British Empire dominated the world. And when the British competed, it was with other Imperial European powers who had their own colonies in the region. After the war, America came to dominate the world by American power and might. Yes, but more important, by American ideals and the opportunity and optimism that America is associated with. To my mind, Singapore is one of the more striking examples of this change. Before the war, Singapore was thought to be impregnable, an island fortress. Then the Japanese army came down the Malay Peninsula on bicycles. The loss of Singapore was devastating strategically to the Allied war effort, but it was even more devastating psychologically for the whole idea of European colonialism. Now, British colonialism was in many ways successful. The British ruled with a light touch, and they helped bring prosperity and the rule of law to those under its dominion. Still, at bottom, British colonialism was doomed, and was doomed because it rested on an unsustainable proposition. This was the supposed superiority of the white man. In the long run, that was untenable on its own. But when Singapore fell to Japan, the British lost more than an outpost. They lost their reigning myth. And the other European powers in Asia fared no better. This wasn't obvious at first. Immediately after the war, the Europeans came back to Asia and resumed control in their former colonies. But independence movements were growing. Some were communist, some were nationalist. All were eager to take their place in the world, and they believed that history had turned. I was given an early taste of this in 1949, when my parents and I visited Singapore. We were on our way to Britain, where I was to begin university. During the war, all Australians had known shortages and deprivation. But what I saw as a young man in Singapore then was my first introduction to real gripping poverty. You could not guess this from looking at Singapore today. But even when I see the gleaming skyscrapers and shiny cars and well-built housing, my mind turns back to the desperation and horror that was Singapore after the war. There was filth everywhere. Mothers carrying their babies begged for food. Thousands of people lived on the streets, not knowing where their next meal would come from. And then we went up to Malaya to visit the British Commissioner General for Southeast Asia, only to find him living in a virtual palace. At the time, I was too young to appreciate the tremendous changes on the horizon. Singapore, for example, has been successful in feeding their poor, housing their homeless, and brilliantly educating the new generations. The irony is that its modern leaders seem to have some of the same worries for their city-state that I do for Australia. In the years after the war, America played a great role in ensuring that the great ferment in the Pacific would be channeled in a mostly peaceful direction. Unlike the British, they had no territorial ambitions. Unlike the British, the end of the war not exhausted but renewed. And unlike the British, the Americans were willing to put their democratic ideals into practice. That led to a wonderful paradox, where the man who presided over the defeat of Imperial Japan, General MacArthur, would help midwife the rise of a democratic Japan. And it worked. Within a few years, a newly democratic Japan was back on its feet and had become a global trading power. Japan's success was soon followed by Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, and South Korea. Later, Malaysia, Indonesia, and others began to expand too. Even communist China, which suffered through starvation and chaos, began to open up. Then in the late 1970s, their leader, a very practical man, was heard to say, "To get rich is glorious." It's true that at different times, some of these countries were led by homegrown dictators who treated their own people as bad as or worse than any colonial oppressors. But they opened up their economies for a practical reason. They understood that to survive, their nations had to be competitive on global markets. This was the first real hint of globalization. And as people in these countries moved from poverty into the middle class, they began demanding other freedoms as well. In places like Korea, Taiwan, and the Philippines, they succeeded. In other parts of Asia, they are still working for it. I was a very young man when the changes that transformed our world began, and I learned some important lessons from these changes. The first is that the greatest asset a nation has is not her natural resources. The greatest asset is her people. If a nation wants to advance, the most important thing is to unlock its human potential. The only way to do that is by giving your people the freedom they need to develop their talents and abilities. If you look around the world, you see a stark truth. Free countries prosper, and unfree countries do not. It's no coincidence that while the Soviet Union had some of the world's best scientists, in a society where information did not flow freely, they could never realize their potential. It is also not a coincidence that when people suffering under dictatorship began to see how others lived and then compared their lot with those of people in free lands, they began to demand their own freedom. And in so doing, they expanded the boundaries of the possible for their compatriots and neighbours. The Oxford of my youth was one of the most privileged places in the world, yet it was a place that had many limits. When I wrote to my parents, it would take a full week for the letter to arrive in Australia. Most people there, students as well as teachers, were white Anglo-Saxon Protestant males. For all our education, the prevailing outlook was narrow and provincial. Class distinctions still elevated the well-born at the expense of the talented. Above all, it was a culture that thought profit grubby and looked down on the world of business. Across our world, millions of people are now entering university each year and enjoying things once limited to the very rich and well-connected. Class distinctions are yielding to merit. Modern businesses are lining up with good jobs and good salaries for the talented. And far from looking down on business, many of today's students dream of starting their own. That is what freedom and information do. They democratize privilege, taking what was once something enjoyed only by the elite and making it available to more and more people. That is the reason why even the poorest student at a school in a poor country probably has access to email and can communicate with those far away more cheaply and more efficiently than I could ever do at Oxford. That is the reason that the son of a poor farmer in Vietnam decides he needs to learn English, and does. And that is the reason the daughter of a shop owner in New Delhi sets about going to graduate school abroad and achieves her goal. Some people call this ambition, as if there's something dirty about ambition. I think it's a healthy thing. In all societies, elites have a habit of trying to kick the ladder away from those trying to climb it. Now, opportunity is almost universal. Knowledge is everywhere, and a lot of it is free. And people who were once poor are taking advantage of these changes. One benefit of growing up poor and struggling to make good is that you are probably better prepared for the competition in a global economy. And you have a sense of optimism that you don't lose when you suffer a setback or two. For me, Australia will always be more than the land of my birth. It is the country that defined who I am, that gave me my first successes, and that still excites feelings of pride and gratitude in my heart. Today, this land offers its people many more opportunities than it did when I was growing up. With so much talent, with so many advantages, and with so much potential, I can think of no greater sadness for this century than in Australia that was willing to settle for just getting by. There was something about this country and its people and its potential that Philip Gibbs, the British war correspondent, noticed when he came across Australian troops in France, where I had three uncles in the trenches. I would love to think that we have remained faithful to the qualities and quirks Gibbs described. This is how he put it. They had no conceit of themselves in a little vain way, but they reckoned themselves the only fighting men, simply and without boasting. I liked the look of them, dusty up to the eyes in summer, muddy up to their eyes in winter. These gypsy fellows, scornful of discipline for discipline's sake, but desperate fighters, looking at life with frank, curious eyes, and a kind of humorous contempt for death and disease and the whole damn show, as they called it. The whole damn show. We are all writing our own scripts for that show. And we should all, every woman and every man, look at life with frank, curious eyes and a kind of humorous contempt. And we should all take advantage of the opportunities that so many of those young Australians were denied so far from home. Thank you for having me.
Rupert Murdoch, with his concluding lecture, The 21st Century, Comforting the Afflicted and Afflicting the Comfortable. His choice of title, after all, and it somehow summarises Rupert Murdoch's own take on his life's work, I think, and what he'd like to be Australia's imprimatur, the way it could explain itself to others, exemplified by those moving Philip Gibbs comments. A very sentimental take, you might say, on the best Australian attributes. Thank you very much for listening over the past 6 weeks. We certainly hope you've been engaged, even if you haven't always agreed. It's been a provocative 6 weeks, to say the least, with perhaps our most notable expatriate, who's guided by this central belief in the cleansing value of competition as a purpose in life, and I think that has infused these lectures. A great account of this is an essay by Mark Bowden, which I might direct you to, July the 18th for the Australian Financial Review, summarising some insights into Rupert Murdoch, which I think have been some of the best that I've read of late, so I'll leave you to pursue that if you wish. The six Boyer lectures are collectively titled A Golden Age of Freedom. All six are available as audio files for download. Transcripts are also available, so I invite you to head to our website and follow the trail to the 2008 Boyer Lectures. As well, a book of the lectures is due out any day through ABC Books, and an audio CD set will be released early in the new year. Geraldine Doogue with you, and great to have your company on Big Ideas here on ABC Radio National. Now to the second half of the program and to the final in-depth conversation conducted by Robin Williams to complement these Boyer Lectures. Today Robin is with Dr. John Jenkin of La Trobe University, who's just written a fascinating book about William and Lawrence Bragg, and it's subtitled The Most Extraordinary Collaboration in Science. Their joint work on crystal structures was awarded the Nobel Prize back in 1915, and to this day, Lawrence Bragg stands as the youngest recipient of the prize, but you didn't know that. Lawrence is the better known of the two, but his dad's story is really worth retelling. It's been 100 years since William settled in South Australia, coming over with, by today's standards, limited qualifications to say the least.
William had just graduated only by a few months from what was called the Mathematical Tripos at Cambridge, which is an honours BA in mathematics with a lot of physics. But he had never given a lecture, as far as I can tell. He had never taught. He'd never done a research project. And he certainly had never published a research paper. He was just a young student, just graduated.
So how did he get what must have been a reasonably senior job in Adelaide?
In those days, the Australian University simply wrote to England and said, "We need a professor, please send us one." And the Agent General for South Australia contacted Cambridge and the most obvious person, J.J. Thompson, and said, "Have you got anybody?" And Thompson looked around Cambridge and suggested two or three people who were interviewed in London, and William Bragg won the job.
And he was virtually a glorified student at the time, and he came out here, and then what happened?
Well, he had a start from a very low base, of course. He had the job initially of teaching all of pure mathematics, all of applied mathematics, all of physics, and all of practical physics, without a single academic colleague or a secretary or a laboratory assistant or a workshop technician. He was entirely on his own. And therefore, only slowly did he extend his wings into public lecturing and ultimately into research, but that came somewhat later.
When it did realise itself towards the end of his time in Australia, how well was he doing?
Partly because he had to do everything himself. He learnt to make apparatus, he learnt the tools of the trade, he began to read the literature, and when he started, he was actually in a very good position to make rapid progress, and he did extraordinarily well. His very first papers were published in England, were noted by everybody, and quickly he was acclaimed as one of the leading researchers in radioactivity, for which he quickly was awarded a Fellowship of the Royal Society, which must have been, and still remains probably, the premier award in the British Empire. And having done that work, he then moved on to the nature of radiation and again made an absolutely outstanding contribution, all of this within 4 or 5 years. It's an amazing story.
Did Adelaide realise what a treasure it had?
Yes, it did, at least from the point of view of his public lecturing. He became absolutely famous in England later for the beauty and the contactability of his public lecturing, and that all actually started in Adelaide. When X-rays were discovered and radio became prominent and so on and so forth, he gave public lectures that absolutely packed out the university lecture theatres to the extent that they had to hire halls outside the university for second and third versions of these lectures.
Well, the amazing thing is that towards the end of the 19th century, Röntgen and X-rays really made a sensation. And you'd expect on the other side of the world that it would have taken years and years and years for all that to come to Australia. How come it turned up so quickly?
Interesting. The 19th century newspapers are worth a look. They didn't have the ability to publish lots of photos and elegant presentation, but they are absolutely chock-a-block with news, both from Australia, and they were getting regular cables from overseas. So the newspapers had news of Röntgen's discovery of X-rays within days almost of its discovery. So there was actually a lot better communication than we give the 19th century credit for.
Young Lawrence, the son of William, and of course his wife, was quite a young boy when he fell off his bike. What happened next?
Yes, his younger brother was riding a tricycle. As so often happens with young children, Lawrence jumped on behind, and where normally they would have proceeded ahead, on this occasion the whole thing tipped over, and his left elbow was very badly shattered. And he went home in great pain, and William decided that the way to look at this thing was to take him to the university and X-ray it. One of the early, not the first, but one of the very early uses of X-rays in Adelaide. And indeed, the elbow was very badly smashed about. There were two family doctors, one Charles Todd Jr., who was his Lawrence's mother's brother, and a man called Lyndon, who was a very good friend of his father. They were both consulted. One said the elbow should be left to set stiff, permanently in a bent position. But the other said, well, perhaps we can reconstruct it by simply placing Lawrence under anaesthetic once a week and exercising the joint and, as it were, forcing all the pieces into their correct position. Sounds absolutely barbaric, doesn't it? And indeed, this was done. He was anaesthetised once a week in great trepidation and terror. He hated the whole procedure, but his smashed elbow was actually forced into correct position. And ever after, although his left arm was slightly too short, he had perfectly good use of it for the rest of his life.
What year was it when the elbow got broken?
Yes, that's a good question. I have to think hard. X-rays were 1885-6, so very soon after, late 1886, I would guess.
And I think Röntgen got the Nobel Prize himself in 1901, roughly.
Yes, that's correct. The first, I think.
Yeah, it's quite amazing, isn't it? And so this happened all so quickly. Of course, in those days, they were using X-rays almost like they use water. You know, it was a miracle technique that had no particular worries about impact on health.
Oh, quite so. And, of course, there are many stories of the early X-ray workers later developing health problems. Yeah, it was a time when there was no safety, basically. It was just a wonderful new tool, and some people used it excessively. I mean, doctors often put their own hand under the beam just to test out that everything was working right.
Extraordinary. Now, Lawrence the son, I've always thought of him as a wonderfully attractive young boy. Handsome, obviously incredibly bright. How did he get on at school?
Yes, he was exceptionally bright, and in those days people got promoted to higher classes. And he found himself at St Peter's College quickly in the sixth form at age 12 or 13, 14, with boys who were 16, 17, 18 years old. And it was, in many ways, a sad time for him. He was ostracised, he was bullied a little bit, and he had to find his own enjoyment and his own activities, both in the free time at school and after hours. So he became a solitary sort of child, doing a lot of shell collecting and associated things without joining much into the games and activities of his fellow students. And the same thing happened at the university, of course. He went there at age 15 when the students were 20-odd. Again, he was incredibly bright. He had to work on his own in the library, and his father recognised that he was lonely, so he invited him to study in his father's office. And that was actually quite counterproductive, because he then was a boy studying in his father's office. His father set the curriculum and gave the lectures. His father set the exam papers, and young Lawrence came top on almost every subject. So you can guess what the other students said. He remembered that period of his life as not particularly happy, actually.
So then, quite young, he went with his father back to England. How did they both respond to being in Europe again?
William, I think, was pleased to be back home, as it was. That's where he'd come from. And he was particularly delighted to be close to people like Rutherford, with whom he'd had an extensive correspondence from Adelaide, but he really enjoyed being close to the action, so to speak, and just a quick train journey to London. Lawrence was, I think, quite happy to be there in many ways. It took him a while to settle down. He says he wasted the first 6 months by not doing anything. I have a contrary opinion. I think those first 6 months were quite vital to his settling in to his new country. He, for example, had a little sketchbook which he took out into the Leeds countryside and sketched away, enjoying the English countryside as completely different from Australia, enjoying sketching, which he had inherited from his mother, who was a lovely artist, and just settling into a totally new environment, so that when he did go up to Cambridge 6 months later, I think he felt relatively at home. There was, however, one downside to this, in that Lawrence was, as I've indicated, rather a shy, introspective person, and he had to consider, how am I going to fit into this new environment? He made the decision, which in the end turned out to be just a little unfortunate. He decided the way to fit in was to try desperately to become an Englishman. So he adopted English dress, I think he changed his accent a little bit, and he tried to pretend he was an Englishman. Now, this had unfortunate implications later, because in general, the English don't particularly like people who pretend to be one of them. They're much more accommodating to people who remain as they are. For example, Ernest Rutherford never had any problems in England. He was always a bit of a New Zealand farmer, and the English loved him in that way.
But his wife did the opposite.
Yes, his wife did the opposite. And in our day, Clive James and Germaine Greer get on fine in England because they remain Australian in many ways. Now, because Lawrence didn't do that, I think he found it hard to be completely accepted.
As for the science, now we're talking about two people who changed the scientific history of the 20th century and changed our lives in every way. You know, they developed those X-rays to look into the very heart of matter to see what shape it was. How did they first come along to, well, in Lawrence's case, move away from radiation and go into the shape of molecules?
Lawrence graduated from Cambridge. He did another undergraduate degree and had started some research in J.J. Thompson's laboratory, which he records later was completely unproductive and was going absolutely nowhere. And he went home for Christmas, like all young people do, and started discussing with his father the latest inventions and discoveries. And they became aware through a letter of an experiment that had been done in Germany to show that X-rays are waves. And this was interesting to the Braggs, because Father Bragg had always thought they were particles. So they sat on the beach in Yorkshire and discussed this. And when they went back to work, so to speak, Father back to his laboratory in Leeds, he began to look at this new work from Germany and try and decide whether he would change his mind from particles to waves. And Lawrence went back to Cambridge to think about the way the Germans had interpreted their experiment, which became clear to him and his father that the Germans, although the experiment was absolutely lovely, the results hadn't been interpreted correctly. And Lawrence pondered all this and not so long after the discovery worked out the correct interpretation. Gave a paper to his Cambridge colleagues, and the rest, as they say, is history.
I think he was 22 then, wasn't he?
Yes, 22 is correct, yeah.
Phenomenally bright, in other words. And the point about that is that what came afterwards, you know, the shape of DNA, the shape of proteins, and the work of Max Perutz and Kendrew, Watson and Crick and all the rest of them, depended on a team that eventually was put together by young Lawrence Bragg.
Yes, and you've raised a very interesting point, because when we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the discovery of DNA, relatively recently, Crick and Watson got an enormous amount of publicity, and that's fine. Lawrence Bragg was almost not mentioned. He'd almost already been forgotten, and yet it was in his laboratory that the whole thing had been discovered. His last major appointment in his career was to the Cavendish Chair of Physics at Cambridge, in succession again to Ernest Rutherford, who had died just a little before. That laboratory was almost completely devoted to nuclear physics, and when Lawrence Bragg took over, he decided it should be decentralised, that nuclear physics could just take a small part, and that all sorts of new things like X-ray crystallography, radio astronomy, low-temperature physics, all sorts of new areas would be introduced, which went down like a lead brick in Cambridge, I can tell you. But he then brought in all sorts of new people to develop these new areas. And one person who came looking at Cambridge was Francis Crick, who had been doing a PhD at the University of London. And during the Second World War, his whole laboratory was completely demolished and his research project was lost. So after the war, he thought, I'd like to get into this X-ray crystallography game. I'll go and see Bragg. So up to Cambridge he went, and Lawrence Bragg gave him a job. And it was there that he began to think about biological implications. And again, one person came knocking on his door one morning named James Watson. And together they solved the problem, but it was all because of Lawrence Bragg, X-ray crystallography and the Cavendish Laboratory.
Yes, I think I counted 11 Nobel Prizes, maybe it's 12 or 30, huge numbers of really transforming experiments and results came out of that laboratory. Why is it then that Lawrence Bragg is so little known, and I think yours is only, what, the third biography of this guy?
Yeah, the second, actually. There is one biography of father, one biography of son, and now mine, which is the two of them together, because I don't think you can treat them separately. The one on father says almost nothing about Lawrence, the one on Lawrence says almost nothing about father, and you can't do it. They've got to be dealt with together, in my opinion. It's not at all clear to me why Lawrence has a rather bad press in England still to the present day. And events occurred late in his career at the Royal Institution, which soured his relationship with some very key people in the Royal Society. And as a result of that, I think, he never received the recognition he deserved for his contributions. He was denied the presidency of the Royal Society when everybody, but everybody, thought he was the obvious choice. And there is a lingering doubt about him on three grounds. Firstly, that still people in England say he's a colonial and therefore second class. They also say that he was awarded his prize much too young.
He was the youngest in history to get the Nobel Prize for Science.
He was indeed. And there are still people in England that say that's much too young to give anybody a prize, however good it might have been. And his personality, I mean, he was a quiet, introspective, shy man, basically. And people found it difficult to relate to him. And so, as I say, it's rather unfortunate. But this underground dislike and criticism remains. One of the things about my book is that I hope it might start to turn that around.
Hope it will. And, of course, the Bragg Initiative in Adelaide, which is going to get the Royal Institution, which he headed, as you said, towards the end of his life in London. The Bragg Initiative is to get something like that to promote science in Australia. Presumably you welcome that.
Oh, indeed I do. And at the launch we heard this rather surprising and exciting news that this is to be just the first of the Royal Institution's branches around the world, presumably. And that is a real coup for Adelaide and a real coup for Australia. And my fervent hope is that the Australian public and even the Australian politicians might get behind such an initiative.
It's interesting, isn't it? People have asked me when the Duke of Kent, who's the president of the Royal Institution, came out, and Susan Greenfield, the successor to Lawrence Bragg, why, you know, here come the POMs again. And I think the answer is there's a vacuum. You've made some comments about Australian universities and the state of science. What's your opinion these days?
My own view is that the universities are in deep trouble. It's interesting, when you walk around them, as I've done recently, they look splendid. The gardens are in great shape, the buildings are being refurbished. What is not so obvious is that they are hurting. They are suffering inside. And there are two major causes, in my opinion. The attempt to turn them into businesses and to bureaucratise them on the one hand, which is disastrous, in my opinion, for their health and well-being. And the other is the fact that students don't give the necessary attention to their studies these days because they're working such long hours in order to support a modern lifestyle. And I think there's a real crisis in universities because students are not applying themselves as they must, in my opinion, to their studies, but regarding work as equally important, so that study gets about half of their time. You can't get a decent degree, in my opinion, if you just spend half your time working on your studies.
What would you like to see happen on our campuses to fix that?
Well, the obvious first requirement is a bit more money, but there needs to be a new appreciation and a new understanding of universities. I don't believe our politicians really understand what it is that goes on in a university. They don't understand what it is to do research. They have no idea how to assess research outcome, although they constantly try to do it. So I would hope for a greater understanding, and that's the kind of thing that the Royal Institution does brilliantly. It tries to take science in an understandable way to the non-experts, and their arrival in Australia is just wonderful.
My final question about William and about Lawrence, the father and son, for me, very famous names. I can't imagine people who have changed the world in such a dramatic fashion, and yet, as you implied, their names are little known to most Australians. Is it important that we know about these people, these scientists as people?
The ABC radio in Melbourne asked its listeners who was the most famous Australian of all time. And the winner of that was Howard Florey, another Adelaide product. And I think it was a splendid decision the public made because Florey was instrumental in making penicillin available. And that was the first of the antibiotics. And ever since then, antibiotics have saved the lives of absolutely millions upon millions of people. I think Lawrence Bragg, with his father, threatens to become at least as important for Australia and for the world, because the biological revolution that they have pioneered in terms of new drugs, of DNA and all the technology that comes out of that, I think their contribution to human wealth and well-being might in the end match that of Howard Florey. And that's the kind of importance I attach to them.
But do we need to know about them as people?
Well, of course, my answer to that is certainly yes. It's a criticism, I think, of science biography in general that we don't write about these people as people enough. My book is very different. You will find discussion of their childhoods, of them falling in love, of them marrying, of their children, of their relationship with their wives, of how they are as fathers and husbands as well as their science and their relationship with their colleagues. So the more we understand scientists as people, the better we shall be. And again, the RI is brilliant at that.
Yes, the RI, the Royal Institution of Great Britain, establishing a twin institution in Adelaide, the home of the Braggs. It's the first time, you know, in its 208-year history that the Royal Institution will set up a base outside of London. So it's quite something, and it will occupy a prominent position, taking up the old Stock Exchange building in the city. Robin Williams talking there to Dr. John Jenkin of La Trobe University. His book is titled William and Lawrence Bragg, Father and Son, The Most Extraordinary Collaboration in Science. And that's the final in this short series of In Conversation as part of our Boyer's Hour. Big Ideas is back next week when we present the annual Hawke Lecture, this year delivered by Professor Fiona Stanley. Her topic, The Great Injustice, Why We Have Failed to Improve the Health of Aboriginal People. It's a powerful oration, as they generally are from Fiona Stanley, from a highly respected Australian. You won't want to miss it. It's next week here on ABC Radio National.
Hello, Michael McKenzie here, inviting you to join forces with Bush Telegraph on a new online project. Our much-loved country viewpoint has a new diving platform called The Pool, where you write about your life outside our cities and then post it for all to see. For more details, visit pool.org.au and keep listening to Bush Telegraph, weekday mornings from 11 on ABC Radio National.